right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. On the line, Professor Bob Harvey. You know, Professor Harvey, you know, as people of color who have, you know, lived through this part of the history of this nation that you know, you would have thought at some point in time, with the nation constantly talking about the shortcomings of other nations, that our nation would get its act together. But yet we're still at a point where that still doesn't happen, Professor Harvey. And I'll tell you something, as a black man who continues to face the kind of hatred that goes on in this country, I don't think this country is in a position to say anything about any other nation until it does what it needs to do to correct what has happened in it.
Well, you know, this is a holier-than-thou attitude that this country has had, you know, and looking out at the rest of the world with our, you know, when our nose, you know, turned up saying that we are the greatest nation in the world and the whole bit. That attitude now is changing. And it's changing because, white America has come to realize that, we're not all what we're cut out to be because we're too busy trying to tell other people how to live. We've developed a degree of hatred ourselves, and we have done very little, Earl, of anything. We've done very little to curb this sense of white nationalism that this country has and has had over the years. We've done very little to curtail that, very, very little. And those groups that we've allowed to hang around have become emboldened. They finally ran across an individual that has emboldened them. And that individual has led this country to believe that it's okay, you know, to use as a valve to alleviate the frustrations of its majority population by forcing them to stay in power as long as they can and giving them an outlet. You know, letting them have their night in the sun. They now feel and believe that. And so it's a very difficult situation that they've gotten themselves into to allow these groups to hang around, because the Ku Klux Klan should have been done away with a long time ago, Earl.
But Professor Harvey, they've sanitized it. So, you know, white nationalism doesn't sound so bad. Right? I mean, Proud Boys.
Not when they're in trouble. And the thing is that those individuals, who they look at the frustration, and a lot of that frustration is caused by the Republican Party has done, or corporate America. So they know what they're doing, Earl. They realize that the best thing for them to do is to make sure that they can pass the blame on to someone and blame someone else, and the American people will have to buy into
Professor
it.
Professor Harvey, let's be clear. The Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, all these other groups, they really aren't filled with, you know, college graduates who are doing well in the society. They are filled for the most part with, again, guys who are in the military. You know, some law enforcement officers, retired law enforcement officers, and really some guys who are just everyday Joes who have not been able to really, you know, make it well in the society. And they're angry about their lot in the society because they feel like, you know, because of the color of their skin, they should be doing better. And so they
exactly. And so the stopgap for that. I mean, one of the things you learn about American history, and I equate so much the time period between 1850 all the way up until the end of the Civil War in 1865. I look so much at the face of America at that time. You didn't have global TV. You didn't have the news media outlets and the whole bit to showcase it. But the same attitudes were there. Most whites. In 1860, when the Civil War started, by the time we got to 1860, the 1850 time period, that 10-year period prior to leading up to 1860, was just tied up with the hatred towards slavery on one side, the desire to want to expand slavery on the other, and the central dynamo that pushed that scenario were rich Southern white men and some white men who lived up north who had textile factories, because most of your textile factories during that time period were up north. So what you saw was a Congress that was paralyzed. They elected presidents, to during that time period prior to Lincoln, they elected presidents that had a pro-slavery attitude about them. Even Lincoln had that. He wasn't opposed completely to slavery. He was just opposed to the expansion. So you had all of that burning there. But one of the key things that really made it work was that having slavery for Southern whites, at least poor whites, allowed them to have somebody to hate. And so as a result of that, when you look at the census data in 1860, you had you had 7 million white people living in the South, and you had 4 million slaves. So you had 11 million people living in the South. But 7 million of them, of that 7 million, only about 350,000 of them were of the so-called planter class, or they were merchants that supported the planter class. But the majority of white America in the South in 1860 didn't own any slaves, Earl. But most of the slave patrols and most of the punitive patrols they needed, you know, to run prisons or to get forced labor out of blacks, most of those were run by everyday poor whites. And so yet many of the jobs that they could have had in all types of supporting industries, they didn't have them because the slaves had them. That further increased the resentment.
But the slaves were working for free.
Were working for free, but the bottom line is that every Southern state had a poor or low economic index when compared to the rest of the country. It was a locked-in system. Eugene Genovese wrote two classic books dealing with the situation of slavery in the South. One was the political economy of slavery, you know. And right now, off the top of my head, I can't think of the other one. But he had to put out two books looking at explaining the economic engine that drove the South and that the South was doomed to fail. Remember, by 1830. The South, slavery was on its way out, because tobacco, which had been the dominant agricultural product, the world's market was flooded with it, and there was no great demand on it. But all of a sudden, they discovered a crop that was growing in the wild down South, and it was cotton. And every Southern state had some more than others, but every Southern state found that they grew cotton in the wild in the South. So they began to cultivate cotton, and it exploded. And that's where you get the word the Cotton Kingdom from. It became the number one economy. By 1860, it was the number one economy. But it didn't benefit most white folk. But when the time came to fight the Civil War, as justification, they started pushing the idea of states' rights. and an independent nation. And many poor whites who were struggling in the South bought into it. They bought into it. So roughly, 29 to 21% of the population dictated and controlled the other 79%. And whites went to war, and there were, in essence, almost 240,000 white men from the Confederacy died in the Civil War. And when the war was over, they were in the same boat they were in before the war started.
So Professor
Harvey. Nothing.
So, Professor Harvey, are you kind of pointing to the fact that there's still a segment of white males who feel that same feelings, feel those same feelings,
yes,
at these?
Yes. And in fact, to be more succinct and brutally honest about it, the majority of them feel that way. And the sad thing about it, Earl, is it's the same mindset, because I kept trying to figure. I mean, one of the areas that I've always concentrated on historically and in a scholarly fashion is trying to figure out why in the world did all of those white men throw their lives into a conflict for an institution where they had no control over them, because the slave masters ran the Southern economy. And why did those men sign up to die, and why did they, since the 1860s, for well over 100 years, they still maintain this defiance of the federal government? Because not, if you think they hated black folk and the federal government before the Civil War, hell, they hated them even more after the war was over. And as I saw in a quote from, it may have been from Imamu Baraka, used to be Leroy Jones, the famous poet, who said, you know, yeah, the Confederacy lost the war, but they won the peace. And so that hatred has been around, Earl, since then. I've been tracking it for a long time, and the seed that I saw on January 6th, that seed of hatred for the government and for people of color, that white nationalist attitude, has always been there.
Professor Harvey, hang on, hold that thought. 844-967-2789. Professor Bob Harvey is holding class. We'll be back. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Be right back.